Welcome to Washington in Focus, your source for the week's top stories in the state of Washington. I'm Cole Lauterbach, managing editor for the Center Square Newswire service. This week, we will be discussing lawmakers accused of playing sides as three of the six state ballot propositions got their day in the legislature, a tiny fraction of homeless people causing the lion's share of Spokane's new vagrancy ordinance prosecutions, how following with California and Quebec could potentially lower gas prices in Washington, and more on the aftermath of Seattle's well-intentioned gig worker ordinance. That's ahead on Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach.
Knowledge is power, and you deserve to know what happens in your state government. That's why the nonprofit Franklin News Foundation is bringing you straight news journalism through the Center Square, reporting on state authorities and publishing stories that show where your money goes and who spends it. By supporting the Center Square, you can track politicians' use of taxpayer money and demand transparency from elected officials. This is how we can equip everyday Americans to hold their government accountable. Become a supporter of Franklin today at franklinnews.org/donate.
Welcome back to Washington in Focus. I'm Cole Lauterbach. Now, let's jump into the headlines. Our first story comes out of Olympia, where lawmakers found the time to consider some of the state's six proposed ballot measures. Capitol reporter Carlene Johnson sat in on them. Carlene, which ones got considered?
We had three that got hearings this week, one on the income tax ban that was held on Tuesday. And then there were two hearings on Wednesday of this week, one concerning the police pursuit laws and the other concerning parental rights and making sure that parents, have access to curriculum, easy access to curriculum, know if their kids are talking to anyone at school about it, say, gender change or concern about sexuality. Parents are very concerned about that. That one, that and the police pursuit hearing were both standing room only.
Turnout looked pretty impressive, not only in person, but online too, right?
Yeah, there were a whole bunch of people that had signed in to testify. I'll give an example on the police pursuit initiative 2113 to reduce requirements for law enforcement to engage in vehicle pursuits. There were more than 5,300 people that signed in support of the initiative online. 177 people prior to the hearing that had signed in opposition. And you had 150 people that had signed up to testify, though very few got an opportunity to do so.
Yeah, you reported that. So people made the drive all the way out to Olympia only to be turned away.
Yeah, you had several members of law enforcement, including sheriffs from Mason County, Thurston County, other members of law enforcement that, had hoped to be able to have a chance to speak to this. You know, this is the restrictions on police pursuits has directly impacted, their departments. They've got the stories. They know how it has, emboldened the criminals and had just this traumatic impact all the way down where, the criminals feel that they can get away with anything. And in fact, Thurston County Sheriff Derek Sanders told me after the hearing, he was, first of all, very disappointed not to get a chance to offer his testimony to lawmakers. And secondly, he said, if somebody could see the dramatic impact on the officers, all of my deputies, the morale, just how beaten down they feel because they can't protect the community they serve and love, he said nobody would support not moving ahead with this initiative.
And now, there were thousands of people and hundreds that showed up to speak, but you found that people were saying lawmakers were playing politics. Who got the majority of the time to make their voices heard in these hearings?
Yeah, and in actually all three of the hearings, including the income tax ban 2111, all three of the measures were, I think the income tax measure 2111 on Tuesday, the first 22 minutes were spent with staff briefings and Democrats who are in a wide majority, of course, in Olympia, asking questions of staff. And it did seem as if, my opinion and that of several people I spoke to afterwards, as if things had kind of been staged. Staff knew exactly what the questions were going to be. In fact, in one case, in the police pursuit hearing yesterday or on Wednesday, the one of the questions came from Representative Tara Simmons, who asked about the disproportionality of those who are of color are impacted when police pursuit rules are lessened. There's less restrictions. She quoted some recent report about that. Well, the staff member was prepared, obviously, for that exact question, and then pulled up a PowerPoint to show some of those statistics. So it did seem to many as if it was prepped. And in fact, the first 35 minutes of the police pursuit hearing was spent taken up by majority Democrats and staff briefing, responding to questions, leaving only 25 minutes for testimony.
We heard some pretty emotional testimony, too. There was one woman who's who lost family over a someone that stole a car and took off, and there was a terrible wreck, right?
Yes, this was a woman by the name of Amber Goldade who lost her 12-year-old daughter, Immaculee, and Immaculee's best friend, Kathleen. They were struck from behind by a speeding motorist in a stolen vehicle who was also high on meth. This guy, 2 weeks prior, had been involved in a pretty high-profile situation where some DOT vehicles and other equipment were stolen out of a yard. The police responded en masse and were chasing this gentleman and were unable to continue the pursuit at the time because they didn't have probable cause that he had, in fact, committed a violent crime. Only 2 weeks later, in one of the stolen vehicles from that scene, did he strike and kill this 12-year-old girl and critically injure her best friend. And the mom was very emotional. And she said, please, please, you know, pass this. This is going to happen to more families like ours.
I mean, and we've heard stories before, too, of some of these criminals know and understand the situation, and they know that they can't be chased. And you've seen police say, you can't, you know, they're yelling out and responding that, you know, after getting stopped, that they tried to get away and only then to then be caught. And the perpetrators, the suspects will say, what are you doing? You can't chase me. I know the law here. You're not supposed to be able to chase me. So it's not as though the criminal element of Washington is unaware of what they can and cannot do. And we've seen that too with looters, where they're very aware of what they can and cannot be arrested for or stopped for. And it seems to have emboldened them quite a bit. Now, in Washington, compared to other states, the hearings and the discussion and the process itself is a little novel, where they did get discussed, but there were no votes that took place. Carlene, could you explain the next steps for these three propositions that did get that preliminary discussion?
Right. Yeah, it is a bit, frustrating not to sort of have that conclusion at the end of these very short hearings. But what is expected at this point is that both chambers, House and Senate, will bring these to the floor for votes on Friday. Now, we have not been told yet. So are they going to expedite them out of committee with a due pass at some point today? And that just kind of is a, subtext in following the legislation, the initiatives to the legislature, and then come up for full votes on Friday. We are still hearing from Republicans in leadership that they still have an expectation that all three of these initiatives that got hearings this week will pass, because these are the ones that majority Democrats know there is overwhelming support for. And that means that cap and trade and long-term care and those other measures are the other three are going to be most likely on the November ballot. Although, based on the numbers of people that signed those from both sides, meaning Republicans, independents, Democrats, those are likely to pass in November as well.
A reminder, Washington in Focus is recorded on Thursday, February 29th. We will have the latest at thecentersquare.com for the results of any potential Friday votes. Thank you, Carlene. Out to Spokane we go, where investigative reporter TJ Martinell dug into just who is violating the city's public vagrancy ordinance, referred to as Sit and Lie. TJ, start us off by giving a description of what this local law forbids.
So the local law forbids camping or sitting on public sidewalks during the day, and the day is defined as 6 a.m. to midnight. So for basically 6 hours, it is acceptable to sit or camp on public sidewalks, but that's during the night. during the day, you can't. And this is in a very specific part of Spokane, mainly in the downtown area.
But there's been a bit of a hold on it, though, right? You've got court cases that they're kind of waiting to see whether or not it's constitutional.
So it was originally enacted in 2013. It got put on hold by the city. There was a 2018 state Supreme Court decision, Martin versus the city of Boise, and that it had to do with anti-camping ordinances. And so they reinstituted it in 2022. So the new version of the ordinance, or at least their restarted enforcement, started in October of 2022.
Okay. So, but in the meantime, we're hearing about some serious crime as these people who would commit these misdemeanors are getting more bold.
Yes, as I've talked to some business owners, they've complained that not only are these people camping, they're camping on their properties, they're assaulting employees who are trying to get into the actual business building. And so it's not just a sit and lie ordinance that many of these people are violating.
We're still seeing arrests, and you dug through and, you know, tell me about where you got the data first.
It was through a public records request with the city of Spokane.
And now you went through not only the arrest, but the prosecutions. And you, as you started digging through this, you started to see a pattern emerge. Tell us about what you found.
Well, what I found is I went through the list of all the different prosecutions and started recording how many offenses or how many prosecutions involved the same person. And what I found is that there were 23 people who, during this time frame, that had committed more than one or were being prosecuted for more than one violation of this sit and lie ordinance. And together they made up basically almost half of all the total prosecution cases that the city decided to pursue.
Right. So you're slicing this up multiple times here. So it's a fraction of a fraction of a fraction.
Right.
Because it was 23. So fewer than two dozen people were responsible for 47 or 48% of all of the prosecutions. And that's just the number of the arrests and prosecutions, not counting the entire homeless population. What is the percentage if you consider what those 23 people out of everyone that's considered had been counted in the point in time count that's done every January?
Yeah. So the total homeless population that was counted last in the point in contact is 2,390. So these 23 make up 1% of the total homeless population in the city or county.
So you have a tiny, minuscule percentage of the total population that is homeless, that considers themselves homeless in Spokane, not only in percentage of the entire population of Spokane, that's causing these problems that we've heard these horror stories coming from downtown Spokane. There was one wild story you gave, you'd heard from a downtown business owner that was like built like a linebacker, this giant of a man, where this tiny little homeless guy came at him and started trying to bite him. You know, it's common. Police, we've seen in other places where police will make arrests only to see a suspect, never see a courtroom. Now, that's happening in this case to an extent. But when you think about the greater percentage that are only given, say, a warning, what did the Spokane PD have to say in response to the questions you sent them?
Well, they didn't really want to weigh in too much on the rate of prosecution, which was around 64%, because they said there's just too many variables. And one of the reasons for the variables is that some of these sent lie ordinance violations were prosecuted at a separate court because the person, as we've noted with several of the people, they commit other offenses that belong in a different court. They may also just decide not to pursue charges on that because they're just going to focus on more serious cases, or they're not going to get much of a sentence out of them because it is a misdemeanor. That means that they're going to get a fine. The other issue is that they just don't know enough about some of some of these cases. They just don't have enough information. That's what their argument on that. Regarding the repeat offenders, that doesn't surprise them. This is kind of an example of Pareto's law, where you have a very disproportionate amount of small amount of people responsible for the vast majority of whatever activity you're describing.
We'll see if city officials pick up on this fact that the majority of these, almost near majority of these cases and prosecutions are being committed by such a small percentage, and see if they act accordingly in terms of how they change policy moving forward to see if they can't more pinpoint on these people. Thank you, TJ. Moving on, California, and to a lesser extent, Quebec, have reputations for everything being more expensive than other areas. Many Californians move to Washington State and other places for the cost of living alone. However, now the two jurisdictions do sell one thing that is much cheaper than Washington, and that's carbon credits. Washington editor Brett Davis has been tracking the joint carbon auctions for some time now. Brett, give us a rough difference in pricing between the two different auctions.
All right. So I went back and looked at auction settlement prices in Washington. That is the price announced at the conclusion of each auction for the quarterly auctions that were held last year. And the lowest price was $48.50, and the highest price was $63.03. And if you look at the California-Quebec joint market's latest auction on February 14th, the settlement price for a vintage 2024 allowance was $41.76. And the settlement price for an advanced vintage 2027 allowance was $41. So as you can see, quite a bit cheaper than Washington.
Now, you spoke to Todd Myers of Washington Policy Center. He sees these numbers and considering, you know, the state is trying to link with California and Quebec into their carbon auction. What was his reaction to it?
He called it a good thing. He said small markets like Washington's, they can be impacted by, they're very volatile. They can be impacted by things like weather events or economic changes. But connecting Washington's market to the larger California-Quebec market would help absorb the shocks in one part of the market by spreading it out throughout the entire market. Now, he did note that while California and Quebec's price allowances have increased 50% in the last year, they're still actually lower than Washington's prices.
It's a fraction, yeah, right. Because Washington has been so volatile. Now, we've heard Washington's market needs this link to survive. So this is existential to getting this market to long-term viability. But there's still pushback on this, right?
Right. Pushback from all sides. Some Republican legislators, they're skeptical of linking Washington's market to California and Quebec because they cite California's highest in the nation gas prices, and they point out Washington's gas prices are the third worst in the nation, and they think that, you know, this will only worsen that, only worsen Washington's affordable energy crisis. And then on the other side, you have environmental groups who are concerned that Washington will basically have to lower its standards to join the California-Quebec club, and it's going to, you know, cause more harm and weaken Washington's already existing, you know, quality air quality improvement programs.
The legislation that's going through right now is not like a final, you know, Governor Inslee signs this and then all of a sudden, you know, we're in the club. Washington right. would have to kind of enter a negotiation that would satisfy California and Quebec's sides to say, yes, you can sell credits on this joint market. And we've heard progressives. The pushback is that they fought hard for these reforms that, you know, are meant to save the environment, even though that's debatable because a lot of these things don't really have any effect on the environment in terms of the money that they raise and stuff like that.
So we're still in the early stages of this process. I think the earliest Washington could join the California-Quebec market would be 2025.
And if it survives at all, considering that this November, voters could scrap the carbon auction entirely. And we've discussed in conversations before, it's never, you know, made a story, but it was something that we had talked about what is California and Quebec going to think in discussions about the potential for joining, allowing Washington to join, if they've got a consistent threat of a ballot proposition to scrap the law itself? If this does, even if it does survive this November's carbon auction repeal effort, I mean, who's to say that the people would not take another bite at the apple? And it seems like there's a lot of people really upset about it because it's made gas 50 cents a gallon higher. There was times this summer where Washington, a state that has, you know, access to pipelines, is, you know, relative to California, environmentally cheaper in terms of producing oil and refining it into gasoline. It was some of the highest prices per gallon in the nation. Everybody, pretty much the consensus became, yeah, it's because of the carbon auction driving prices up. So we will we'll track this, but it's a very, very complicated situation, and it's intriguing, to say the least. Thank you, Brett. We round out our trip in Seattle, where the city's new gig worker ordinance intended to help those contract workers earn a living wage has created some unintended consequences. Seattle reporter Spencer Pauly's been following this story. Spencer, what happened this week?
So this week, Uber revealed its data on food delivery orders and showing the effects of two gig laws that were recently enacted in the city of Seattle. Now, the latest data shows that Uber Eats reported a 30% decrease in order volumes since the laws were enacted in the middle of January this year.
That's a significant drop. I mean, you're talking about people's livelihoods here because people rely on, you know, this gig worker economy to make rent. And, you know, where if they've got another job, they can't pay the bills with just that. It's not just Uber. You spoke with their competitor DoorDash. What was it, last week, right? They saw something similar.
Yes, last week, DoorDash reported 30,000 fewer orders from their site since this was enacted, and this is because of just the increases in cost to consumers since this law was passed. Now, DoorDash and Uber Eats warned that they will install fees to, you know, to supplement the costs that are associated with these new ordinances. And going back to what you said, Cole, you know, this not only does this affect the delivery drivers that rely on these payments, you know, these side hustles or whatever you want to call it, but also a lot of the small businesses within the city rely on delivery orders. Right. You know, these are small spaces that may not have a lot of dine-in seating, but they rely a lot on deliveries. And just based on this alone, a lot of people are not using these services, and that's costing, you know, businesses.
And something you had seen during in 2020 is a lot of businesses that would have otherwise closed, they changed their business model to lower their footprint, their, you know, the restaurant size or something like that, and became much more reliant on these gig worker economy delivery food, models. And in Seattle, if you have businesses that are doing the same, this could have been the straw that breaks a camel's back of a camel that survived the COVID-19 pandemic. Spencer, explain the details of the ordinance that took effect last month for people not familiar with what the requirements are.
So there were two ordinances that were enacted last month. The first one is the app-based worker minimum payment ordinance. And this requires network companies like your DoorDash, your Uber Eats to pay the greater of a minimum per minute amount of 44 cents and a minimum offer amount of $5. This is to create a sort of minimum wage for delivery drivers so they can kind of, or, you know, have a sustainable income per se. And the other ordinance was the app-based worker paid sick time, which allows Seattle-based workers to accrue 1 day of paid sick time for every 30 days they work within the city of Seattle. Now, these were well-intentioned laws to supplement workers that rely on these apps. But in turn, it seems like so far, within a few weeks, it's shown the opposite effect.
And now, you're no Iron Chef. I know you've ordered out before and have used these services in the past. What was the difference in cost to the consumer that you had seen, just anecdotally?
Right. Well, I have to become an Iron Chef now because of the cost. So since this law was passed, I try to order some Vietnamese food from a local spot I like. And usually it's a $25 order, which to me is kind of high already. Once I went to the checkout button, it went up to $60 without a tip. So instead, I had to cancel that order and hike over to get it myself because I would rather do that than pay that much more. So
I mean, before this took effect, it was kind of a, you know, it was a pain, but it was worth the convenience. And now you crossed over into that, you've crossed that threshold into no longer worth it in terms of the pain of that sticker shock. You heard from the drivers in the city that said this is killing us. We're dying on the vine out here. What's the city council said in terms of understanding that this fallout's happening all around them because of the ordinance that they passed?
A lot of these are new city council members who are starting getting up to date what's going on here. But incumbent Seattle City Council member Sarah Nelson was against this ordinance at first when it was first being proposed, because saying this could have effects that it is having within, you know, local economy. Nelson acknowledged workers because they went to City Hall last week to, you know, oppose this and ask for a repeal of these laws. The drivers I spoke to said they're facing homelessness. They are pinching pennies right now and, you know, looking at the numbers to make sure they can afford rent.
Yeah, this could have deep effects on the entire gig economy in Seattle. We will continue to cover this. Thank you, Spencer, and a big thank you to all of our journalists for sharing their stories today. Stay up to date with these and more at thecentersquare.com. I'm Cole Lauterbach, and until next time, this has been Washington in Focus.